Gardeners brought chairs for them in the shade of a huge old willow beside one of the pools. Tehanu went to stand by the pool, gazing down into the green water where a few big silver carp swam lazily. Clearly, she wanted to think over her father's message, not to talk, though she could hear what they said. When the others were all settled, the king had Alder tell his story yet again. Their silence as they listened was compassionate, and he was able to speak without constraint or hurry. When he was done, they remained silent a while, and then the wizard Onyx asked him one question. "Did you dream last night?" Alder said he had had no dream he could recall. "I did," Onyx said. "I dreamed of the summoner who was my teacher in the school on Roke. They say of him that he died twice, because he came back from that country across the wall. I dreamed of the spirits that are not reborn," Tanar said, very low. Prince Sege said, "All night I thought I heard voices down in the city streets, voices I knew from my childhood, calling as they used to do. But when I listened, it was only watchmen or drunken sailors shouting."
"I never dream," said Tosla. "I didn't dream of that country," the king said. "I remembered it, and couldn't cease remembering it."
He looked at the silent woman, Tehanu, but she only looked down into the pond and did not speak.
No one else spoke, and Alder could not stand it. "If I am a plague bringer, you must send me away," he said.
The wizard Onyx spoke, not imperiously, but with finality.
"If Roke sent you to Gaunt, and Gaunt sent you to Havnor, Havnor is where you should be."
"Many heads make light thinking," said Tosla, sardonic. Labannon said, "Let's put dreams aside for a while. Our guest needs to know what we were concerned about before he came. Why I begged Tanar and Tehanu to come earlier this summer, and summoned Tosla from his voyaging to take counsel with us. Will you tell Alder of this matter, Tosla?" The dark-faced man nodded. The ruby in his ear gleamed like a drop of blood.
"The matter is dragons," he said. "In the West Reach for some years now, they've come to farms and villages on Uli and Uzidero, flying low, seizing the roofs of houses with their talons, shaking them, terrifying the people. In the Torringates, they've come twice now at harvest time and set the fields burning with their breath, and burnt haystacks, and set the thatch of houses afire. They haven't struck at people, but people have died in the fires. They haven't attacked the houses of the lords of those islands, seeking after treasure the way they did in the dark years, but only the villages and the fields. The same word came from a merchantman who'd been southwest as far as Simli, trading for grain. Dragons had come and burnt the crop just as they were harvesting. Then, last winter in Semel, two dragons settled on the summit of the volcano, Mount Andandan."
"Ah," said Onyx, and at the king's inquiring glance, "the wizard Sepal of Palm tells me that mountain was a most sacred place to the dragons, where they came to drink fire from the earth in ancient days."
"Well, they're back," said Tosla. "And they come down harrying the herds and flocks that are the wealth of the people there, not hurting the beasts, but frightening them, so they break loose and run wild. The people say they're young dragons, black and thin, without much fire yet. And in Palm there are dragons living now in the mountains of the north part of the island, wild country without farms. Hunters used to go there to hunt mountain sheep and catch falcons to tame, but they've been driven out by the dragons, and no one goes near the mountains now. Maybe your Pelnish wizard knows about them."
Onyx nodded. He says flights of them have been seen above the mountains like the flights of wild geese. Between Palm and Semel and the island of Avnor is only the width of the Pelnish Sea, said Prince Sege. Alder was thinking that it was less than 100 miles from Semel to his own island town. Tossler set out to the Dragon's Run in his ship, the Tern, the king said, but got barely in sight of the easternmost of those isles before a swarm of the beasts came at me, Tossler said with a hard grin. They harried me as they do the cattle and sheep, swooping down to singe my sails till I ran back where I came from. But that's nothing new. Onyx nodded again. Nobody but a dragon lord has ever sailed the Dragon's Run. I have, the king said, and suddenly smiled a broad, boyish smile. But I was with the dragon lord. Now that's a time I've been thinking about. When I was in the West Reach with the Archmage, seeking Cobb the Necromancer, we passed Jessage, which lies even farther out than Simley, and we saw burned fields there. And in the Dragon's Run we saw that they fought and killed one another like animals gone rabid. After a time Prince Sege asked, could it be that some of those dragons did not recover from their madness in that evil time? It's been 15 years and more, Onyx said. But dragons live very long. Maybe time passes differently for them. Alder noticed that as the wizard spoke, he glanced at Teanu, standing apart from them by the pool. Yet only within the last year or two have they attacked people, said the prince. That they have not, Tossler said. If a dragon wanted to destroy the people of a farm or village, who'd stop it? They've been after people's livelihood. Harvests, hayricks, farms, cattle. They're saying, begone, get out of the west. But why are they saying it with fire, with havoc, the wizard demanded. They can speak. They speak the language of the making. Morad and Aerith Ackby talked with dragons. Our archmage talked with them. Those we saw in the Dragon's Run, the king said, had lost the power of speech. The breach Cobb had made in the world was drawing their power from them, as it did from us. Only the great dragon Orm Embar came to us and spoke to the archmage, telling him to go to Celador. He paused, his eyes far away. And even from Orm Embar, speech was taken before he died. Again, he looked away from them, a strange light in his face. It was for us Orm Embar died. He opened the way for us into the dark land. They were all silent for a while. Tinar's quiet voice broke the silence. Once Sparrowhawk said to me, let me see if I can remember how he said it, that the dragon and the dragon's speech are one thing, one being, that a dragon does not learn the old speech, but is it? As a tern is flight, as a fish is swimming, Onyx said slowly. Yes. Teanu was listening, standing motionless by the pool. They all looked at her now. The look on her mother's face was eager, urgent. Teanu turned her head away. How do you make a dragon talk to you? The king said. He said it lightly, as if it were a pleasantry, but it was followed by another silence. Well, he said, that's something I hope we can learn. Now, Master Onyx, while we are speaking of dragons, will you tell us your story of the girl who came to the school on Roke? For none but me has heard it yet. A girl in the school, said Tossler with a scoffing grin. Things have changed on Roke. Indeed they have, the wizard said with a long, cool look at the sailor. This was some 8 years ago. She came from Wei, disguised as a young man, wanting to study the art magic. Of course, her poor disguise didn't fool the doorkeeper, yet he let her in, and he took her part. At that time, the school was headed by the master summoner. The man, and he hesitated a moment, the man of whom I told you I dreamed last night. Tell us something of that man, if you will, Master Onyx, the king said. That was Thorion, who returned from death? Yes. When the Archmage had been long gone and no word came, we feared he was dead. So the summoner used his arts to go see if indeed he had crossed the wall. He stayed long there, so the masters feared for him too. But at last he woke and said that the Archmage was there among the dead and would not return himself, but had bade Thorion return to govern Roke. Yet before long the dragon bore the Archmage Sparrowhawk living to us, with my lord Labannon. Then, when the Archmage had departed again, the summoner fell down, and lay as if life had gone out of him. The master Herbal, with all his art, believed him dead. Yet, as we made ready to bury him, he moved and spoke, saying he had come back to life to do what must be done. So, since we were not able to choose a new archmage, Thorion the summoner governed the school. He paused. When the girl came, though the doorkeeper had admitted her, Thorion would not have her within the walls. He would have nothing to do with her. But the master patterner took her to the grove, and she lived there some while at the edge of the trees, and walked with him among them. He and the doorkeeper and the herbal and Kurram Karmeruk, the namer, believed that there was a reason she had come to Roke, that she was a messenger or an agent of some great event, even if she herself didn't know it. And so they protected her. The other masters followed Thorion, who said she brought only dissension and ruin and should be driven out. I was a student then. It was a sore trouble to us to know our masters, masterless, were quarreling. And over a girl, said Tosla. Onyx's look at him this time was extremely cold. Quite, he said. After a minute, he took up his story. To be brief, then, when Thorion sent a group of us to compel her to leave the island, she challenged him to meet her that evening on Roke Knoll. He came and summoned her by her name to obey him. Irion, he called her. But she said, I am not only Irion, and speaking, she changed. She took the form of a dragon. She touched Thorion, and his body fell to dust. Then she climbed the hill, and watching her, we didn't know whether we saw a woman that burned like a fire or a winged beast. But at the summit we saw her clearly, a dragon like a flame of red and gold, and she lifted up her wings and flew into the west. His voice had grown soft, and his face was full of the remembered awe. Nobody spoke. The wizard cleared his throat. Before she went up the hill, the namer asked her, Who are you? She said she did not know her other name. The patterner spoke to her, asking where she would go and whether she would come back. She said she was going beyond the west to learn her name from her own people, but if he called her, she would come. In the silence, a hoarse, weak voice, like metal brushing on metal, spoke. Alder did not understand the words, and yet they seemed familiar, as if he could almost remember what they meant. Tehanu had come close to the wizard and was standing by him, bending to him, tense as a drawn bow. It was she who had spoken. Startled and taken aback, the wizard stared up at her, got to his feet, backed off a step, and then, controlling himself, said, "Yes, those were her words. My people beyond the West." "Call her. Oh, call her," Tehanu whispered, reaching out both her hands to him. Again, he drew back involuntarily. Tinar stood up and murmured to her daughter, "What is it? What is it, Tehanu?" Tehanu stared round at them all. Alder felt as if he were a wraith she saw through. "Call her here," she said. She looked at the king. "Can you call her?" "I have no such power. Perhaps the patterner of Roke. Perhaps you yourself." Tehanu shook her head violently. No, she whispered. "I am not like her. I have no wings." Labanan looked at Tinar as if for guidance. Tinar looked miserably at her daughter. Tehanu turned around and faced the king. "I'm sorry," she said stiffly in her weak, harsh voice. "I have to be alone, sir. I will think about what my father said. I will try to answer what he asked. I have to be alone. Please." Labanan bowed to her and glanced at Tinar, who went at once to her daughter and put an arm about her, and they went away on the sunny path by the pools and fountains. The four men sat down again and said nothing for a few minutes. Labanan said, "You were right, Onyx," and to the others, "Master Onyx told me this tale of the woman dragon Irion after I told him something about Tehanu. How as a child Tehanu summoned the dragon Kalesin to Gaunt and spoke with the dragon in the old speech, and Kalesin called her daughter." "Sire, this is very strange. This is a strange time when a dragon is a woman and when an untaught girl speaks in the language of the making." Onyx was deeply and obviously shaken, frightened. Alder saw that and wondered why he himself felt no such fear. Probably, he thought, because he did not know enough to be afraid, or what to be afraid of. "But there are old stories," Tossla said. "Haven't you heard them on Roke? Maybe your walls keep them out. They're only tales simple people tell. Songs, even. There's a sailor's song, the Lass of Belilo, that tells how a sailor left a pretty girl weeping in every port, until one of the pretty girls flew after his boat on wings of brass and snatched him out of it and ate him." Onyx looked at Tossla with disgust, but Labanan smiled and said, "The woman of Kamai." "The archmage's old master, Ihal, called Ogion, told Tinar about her. She was an old village woman and lived as such. She invited Ogion into her cottage and served him fish soup. But she said mankind and dragonkind had once been one. She herself was a dragon as well as a woman, and being a mage, Ogion saw her as a dragon. As you saw Irion, Onyx." Speaking stiffly and addressing himself to the king only, Onyx said, "After Irion left Roke, the master namer showed us passages in the most ancient lore books, which had always been obscure, but which could be understood to speak of beings both human and dragon, and of a quarrel or great division among them. But none of this is clear to our understanding." "I hoped that Tehanu might make it clear," Labanan said. His voice was even, so that Alder did not know whether he had given up or still held that hope. A man was hurrying down the path to them, a gray-headed soldier of the king's guards. Labanon looked round, stood up, went to him. They conferred for a minute, low-voiced. The soldier strode off again. The king turned back to his companions. "Here is news," he said, the ring of challenge in his voice again. "Over the west of Havnor there have been great flights of dragons. They have set forests afire, and a coaster's crew say people fleeing down to Southport told them the town of Resbel is burning."
That night, the king's swiftest ship carried him and his party across the Bay of Havnor, running fast before the mage wind Onyx raised. They came into the mouth of the Onava River, under the shoulder of Mount On, at daybreak. With them 11 horses were disembarked, fine, strong, slender-legged creatures from the royal stables. Horses were rare on all the islands but Havnor and Semel. Tehanu knew donkeys well enough, but had never seen a horse before. She had spent much of the night with them and their handlers, helping control and calm them. They were well-bred, mannerly horses, but not used to sea voyages. When it came time to mount them, there on the sands of the Onava, Onyx was fairly daunted and had to be coached and encouraged by the handlers, but Tehanu was up in the saddle as soon as the king. She put the reins in her crippled hand and did not use them, seeming to communicate with her mare by other means. So the little caravan set off due west into the foothills of the Falliarns, keeping up a good pace. It was the swiftest way to travel that Labanon had at his disposal. To coast clear round South Havnor would take too long. They had the wizard Onyx with them to keep the weather favorable, clear the path of any obstacles, and defend them from any harm short of dragonfire. Against the dragons, if they encountered them, they had no defense at all, except perhaps Tehanu.
Taking counsel the evening before with his advisers and the officers of his guard, Labanon had quickly concluded that there was no way to fight the dragons or protect the towns and fields from them. Arrows were useless. Shields were useless. Only the greatest mages had ever been able to defeat a dragon. He had no such mage in his service, and knew of none now living, but he must defend his people as best he could, and he knew no way to do it but to try to parley with the dragons. His majordomo had been shocked when he set off for the apartment where Tanar and Tehanu were. The king should send for those he wished to see, command them to come to him. "Not if he's going to beg from them," Labanon said. He told the startled maid who answered their door to ask if he might speak with the White Lady and the Woman of Gaunt. So they were known to the people of the palace and the city. That each bore her true name openly, as the king did, was so rare a matter, so defiant of rule and custom, of safety and propriety, that though people might know the name, they were reluctant to say it and preferred to speak around it. He was admitted, and having told them briefly the news he had received, he said, "Tehanu, it may be that you alone in my kingdom can help me. If you can call to these dragons as you call to Kalesin, if you have any power over them, if you can speak to them and ask why they war on my people, will you do so?" The young woman shrank from his words, turning towards her mother. But Tanar did not offer her any shelter. She stood unmoving. After a while she said, "Tehanu, long ago I told you, when a king speaks to you, you answer. You were a child then and didn't answer. You are not a child now." Tehanu took a step back from them both. Like a child, she hung her head. "I can't call to them," she said in her faint, harsh voice. "I don't know them." "Can you call Kalesin?" Labanon asked. She shook her head. "Too far away," she whispered. "I don't know where." "But you are Kalesin's daughter," Tanar said. "Can you not speak to these dragons?" She said wretchedly, "I don't know." Labanon said, "If there is any chance, Tehanu, that they'll talk to you, that you can talk to them, I beg you to take that chance. For I can't fight them and don't know their language, And how can I find what they want of us from creatures who can destroy me with a breath, with a look? Will you speak for me? For us?" She was silent. Then, so faintly he could barely hear it, she said, "Yes." "Then make ready to travel with me. We leave by the fourth hour of the evening. My people will bring you to the ship. I thank you." "And I thank you, Tanar," he said, taking her hand a moment, but no longer, for he had much to see to before he went. When he came down to the wharf, late and hurrying, there was the slender hooded figure. The last horse to be led aboard was snorting and bracing its feet, refusing to go up the gangplank. Tahanu seemed to be conferring with the handler. Presently she took the horse's bridle and talked to it a little, and they went up the gangplank, quietly together. Ships are small, crowded houses. Labanon heard two of the hostlers talking softly on the afterdeck towards midnight. "She has the true hand," one said, and the other, a younger voice, "Aye, she does, but she's horrible to look at, ain't she?" The first one said, "If a horse don't mind it, why should you?" And the other, "I don't know, but I do." Now as they rode from the Onava sands into the foothills, where the way widened, Tosla brought his horse up beside Babanan's. "She's to be our interpreter, is she?" he asked. "If she can." "Well, she's braver than I'd have thought. That happened to her the first time she talked with a dragon. It's likely to happen again."
"What do you mean?"
"And she was half burned to death."
"Not by a dragon."
"Who then?"
"The people she was born to."
"How was that?" Tosla asked with a grimace. "Tramps, thieves. She was 5 or 6 years old. Whatever she did or they did, it ended in her being beaten unconscious and shoved into their campfire. Thinking, I suppose, she was dead or would die and it would be taken for an accident, they made off. Villagers found her, and Tanar took her in." Tosla scratched his ear. "There's a pretty tale of human kindness. So she's no daughter of the old archmage, either. But then what do they mean saying she's a dragon's get?"
Labanon had sailed with Tosla, had fought beside him years ago in the siege of Sora, and knew him a brave, keen, cool-headed man. When Tosla's coarseness chafed him, he blamed his own thin skin. "I don't know what they mean," he answered mildly. "All I know is the dragon called her daughter.
That roque wizard of yours, that Onyx, is quick to say he's no use in this matter, but he can speak the old tongue, can't he?"
"Yes, he could wither you into ash with a few words of it." "If he hasn't, it's out of respect for me, not you, I think." Tosla nodded.
"I know that," he said.
They rode all that day at as quick a pace as the horses could keep, coming at nightfall to a little hill town where the horses could be fed and rested, and the riders could sleep in variously uncomfortable beds. Those of them unused to riding now discovered they could barely walk. The people there had heard nothing about dragons, and were overwhelmed only by the terror and glory of a whole party of rich strangers riding in and wanting oats and beds and paying for them with silver and gold. The riders set off again long before dawn. It was nearly 100 miles from the sands of Onava to Rezbel. This second day would take them over the low pass of the Faliern Mountains and down the western side. Yanai, one of Labanon's most trusted officers, rode well ahead of the others. Tosla was rear guard. Labanon led the main group. He was jogging along half asleep in the dull quiet before dawn when hoofbeats coming towards him woke him. Yanai had come riding back. Labanon looked up where the man was pointing. They had just emerged from the woods on the crest of an open hillside and could see through the clear half-light all the way to the pass. The mountains to either side of it massed black against the dull reddish glow of a cloudy dawn. But they were looking west. "That's nearer than Rezbel," Yanai said. 15 miles, maybe." Tahanu's mare, though small, was the finest of the lot, and had a strong conviction that she should lead the others. If Tahanu didn't hold her back, she would keep sidling and overtaking till she was ahead of the line. The mare came up at once when Labanon reined in his big horse, and so Tahanu was beside him now, looking where he looked. "The forest is burning," he said to her. He could see only the scarred side of her face, so she seemed to gaze blindly. But she saw, and her claw hand that held the reins was trembling. The burned child fears the fire, he thought. What cruel, cowardly folly had possessed him to tell this girl, "Come talk to the dragon, save my skin, and bring her straight into the fire." "We will turn back," he said. Tahanu raised her good hand, pointing. "Look," she said. "Look." A spark from a bonfire, a burning cinder rising over the black line of the pass, an eagle of flame soaring, a dragon flying straight at them. Tahanu stood up in her stirrups and let out a piercing, scraping cry like a seabird's or a hawk's scream. But it was a word, one word. "Medeu!" The great creature drew nearer with terrible speed, its long, thin wings beating almost lazily. It had lost the reflection of fire and looked black or bronze-colored in the growing light. "Mind your horses," Tahanu said in her cracked voice. And just then, Labanan's gray gelding saw the dragon and started violently, tossing its head and backing. He could control it, but behind him, one of the other horses let out a neigh of terror, and he heard them trampling and the handlers' voices. The wizard Onyx came running up and stood beside Labanan's horse. Mounted or afoot, they stood and watched the dragon come. Again, Tahanu cried out that word. The dragon veered in its flight and slowed, came on, stopped, and hovered in the air about 50 feet from them. "Medeu!" Tahanu called, and the answer came like an echo prolonged. "Medeu!" "What does it mean?" Labanan asked, bending to Onyx.
"Sister, brother,"
the wizard whispered. Tahanu was off her horse and had tossed the reins to Yunai, was walking forward down the slight slope to where the dragon hovered, its long wings beating quick and short like a hovering hawk's. But these wings were 50 feet from tip to tip, and as they beat they made a sound like kettle drums or rattles of brass. As she came closer to it, a little curl of fire escaped from the dragon's long, long-toothed open mouth. She held up her hand, not the slender brown hand, but the burned one, the claw. The scarring of her arm and shoulder kept her from raising it fully. She could reach barely as high as her head. The dragon sank a little in the air, lowered its head, and touched her hand with its lean, flared, scaled snout. Like a dog, an animal greeting and sniffing, Labanan thought. Like a falcon stooping to the wrist. Like a king bowing to a queen. Tahanu spoke. The dragon spoke. Both briefly. In their cymbal shiver voices. Another exchange, a pause. The dragon spoke at length. Onyx listened intently. One more exchange of words. A wisp of smoke from the dragon's nostrils. A stiff, imperious gesture of the woman's crippled, withered hand. She spoke clearly two words. "Bring her," the wizard translated in a whisper. The dragon beat its wings hard, lowered its long head and hissed, spoke again, then sprang up into the air high over Tahanu, turned, wheeled once, and set off like an arrow to the west.
"It called her daughter of the eldest," the wizard whispered, as Tahanu stood motionless, watching the dragon go.
She turned around, looking small and fragile in that great sweep of hill and forest, in the gray dawn light. Labanan swung off his horse and hurried forward to her. He thought to find her drained and terrified. He put out his hand to help her walk. But she smiled at him. Her face, half terrible, half beautiful, shone with the red light of the unrisen sun. "They won't strike again. They will wait in the mountains," he said. Then indeed she looked around as if she did not know where she was, and when Labanan took her arm, she let him do so. But the fire and the smile lingered in her face, and she walked lightly. While the hostlers held the horses, already grazing on the dew-wet grass, Onyx, Tosla, and Yunai came round her, though they kept a respectful distance. Onyx said,
"My lady Tahanu, I have never seen so brave an act."
"Nor I," Tosla said. "I was afraid," Tahanu said in her voice that carried no emotion. "But I called him brother, and he called me sister.
I could not understand all you said, the wizard said. I have no such knowledge of the old speech as you. Will you tell us what passed between you?
She spoke slowly, her eyes on the west where the dragon had flown. The dull red of the distant fire was paling as the east grew bright. I said, why are you burning the king's island? And he said, it is time we have our own lands again. And I said, did the eldest bid you take them with fire? Then he said that the eldest, Kalesin, had gone with Orm Irion beyond the west to fly on the other wind. And he said, the young dragons who remained here, on the winds of the world, say men are oathbreakers who stole the dragon's lands. They tell one another that Kalesin will never return, and they will wait no longer, but will drive men out of all the western lands. But lately Orm Irion has returned and is on Pollen, he said. And I told him to ask her to come, and he said she would come to Kalesin's daughter.